We have to strike that balance between being true to the grotesque, but also our work is not merely the work of a journalist. Our work is the work of an artist to bring the beautiful aspects of Christ crucified. And they're present. They're there.
Welcome to the Habit Podcast, conversations with writers about writing. I'm Jonathan Rogers, your host. When Pastor Brian Zond was walking 500 miles across Spain on the Camino de Santiago, he contemplated hundreds of crosses and crucifixes, and he asked the question, what does this mean? Why is the image of a man nailed to a tree the most commonly represented story image in the world? Those ruminations gave rise to his new book, The Wood Between the Worlds, A Poetic Theology of the Cross. In this episode, Brian Zond and I talk about theopoetics, the eternal recurrence of holy awe, and the role of aesthetics in the life of the church. Brian Zond, I'm happy to have you on the Habit Podcast today to talk about your new or newish book, The Wood Between the Worlds. So thanks for being here.
Thank you, Jonathan. Thank you for having me.
Let's just start. How do you describe this book when you're explaining in, let's say, 90 seconds or less? How do you explain what this book is?
I describe it as a kaleidoscopic examination of the cross. I don't like the idea that discussions theologically about the cross so often devolve into, let's come up with a single atonement theory in a sentence or two to describe the cross and then argue about why this one's right and all the rest are wrong. And so there's 19 chapters and a rather long poem at the end. Each one are a different take upon looking at the cross. I call it kaleidoscopic because you know how a kaleidoscope works. You look at a source of light, you see the colors, you see the geometric design, then you turn the kaleidoscope. And though it's the same source of light, you get a different design, different colors. And so I'm looking at the cross and not trying to come up with a definitive statement that ends the conversation, but a legitimate, true, honest conversation about what we encounter when we consider Jesus Christ and Him crucified.
Yeah, you talk about seeking an eternal recurrence of holy awe instead of a final word.
Yeah, I'm kind of working off of these angelic creatures that we read about in Revelation 4 who stand before the throne of God and day nor night, they cease not to say, holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty, who was and is to come. And so I ask my question, well, what kind of job do they have? Are they have the most boring job in the universe? Are they automatons on infinite repeat? And I think, no, I think maybe it's more like this, that they are granted a glimpse of a particular aspect of the glory of God, and then it erupts out of them, holy, 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 and then another glimpse. And so that each expression of praise is a instant reaction to the glory they're seeing. And I think that's closer to how we should be able to talk about the cross rather than to come up with a single statement and then we're done with that. Next question, please.
Yeah, I guess, when you look at a kaleidoscope, you say, wow, and then you move it and you say, wow, again. You may not have different words even.
Right.
That's but what wow I like. Means little something different every time you see it.
Yeah,
I was certainly thinking of Fleming Rutledge's book on the crucifixion as I was reading yours, it's not settling on one theory of atonement, but kind of, running through several.
Lynn Rutledge is an inspiration to me. She's a friend at a distance. I always describe her like this. I said, I admire her and slightly fear her.
Yeah.
She doesn't suffer fools gladly. And I mean that as a compliment. Uh-huh. But she's been kind to me. I appreciate all that she has done and her work, her writing, her preaching. I'm a big fan.
Yeah, I have I've made it a custom to read through her crucifixion book for Lent. I skipped this year for reasons that I don't even know what the reason was, but I love that book. You use the word theopoetics.
Yeah.
Did you coin that phrase?
I didn't, and I've been asked where I came up with it. It's not original with me, and I can't remember where I first found it. Uh-huh. And I've racked my brain and I can't remember how that came into my vocabulary, but it's not original with me.
Yeah. What does it mean?
It means to not be limited to academic prose in how we engage in theological conversation, which in fact is what the Bible does. Much of the Bible does not necessarily read, most of it, and I would say, doesn't read like academic prose. I mean, there's so much poetry in the Bible, more than people probably suspect. Yeah. Clearly, yes, you know the Psalms, and maybe people know that the literary prophets from Isaiah through Malachi, that's all poetry. Yeah. But so much of even the New Testament, you know, John, so much in John's gospel or Paul's Ode to Love or Romans 8, so many passages are poetic in nature. And so I don't think that to take a poetic approach to attempting to speak on the ineffable that is God is a flight of fancy. I think at times it may be the only recourse. And then I also mean, because I don't mean that this book is a book of poetry, because clearly it's not. Mm-hmm. It just means I'm willing to engage in more poetic language. And even by poetic, I'm actually then employing not just poetry, but literature, film, painting, song, all of that. I am saying, no, that is a legitimate source of vocabulary for trying to communicate what I see when I look at the cross.
Mm, yeah. You say, and I was interested in this idea, and I want to push on a little bit. You said that theopoetics seeks to rise above dogma that shuts down conversation. So dogma shuts down conversation. Theopoetics invites more conversation. And I wanted to ask you to put that alongside something Flannery O'Connor said, which is that dogma is the guardian of mystery. And then she goes on to say, the doctrines are spiritually significant in ways that we cannot fathom. Is this you disagreeing with Flannery O'Connor, which is not allowed on this podcast, by the way?
Far be it for me to disagree with Flannery O'Connor.
That's the right answer.
She's an artist, all right? So I'm going to say, no, she's in my corner.
Yeah.
And she would be a prime example of someone who's engaging in what I would call theopoetics.
Yeah.
That, as far as I know, she never wrote anything that would approach what we would describe as academic prose, theology, but her books just drip with it. And so maybe the word dogma and dogmatic can be used in a more technical sense, and that's what Flannery is doing there, or in a more perhaps unwise, but you know, it's one sentence in the book, and more pejorative sense that I used it there. What I would say, though, is what we can say dogmatically about the cross is pretty limited.
Yeah.
I mean, look, in the creeds, really all we confess is that he suffered under Pontius Pilate, was crucified, died, and was buried and raised on the third day.
Yeah.
And so, or if we go to the scriptures, you know, maybe we draw from Paul in 1 Corinthians 15, we say Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures. That's a dogmatic statement. But then beyond that, what else can we say? And what I do resist is the idea that someone's single atonement theory, and I'm kind of looking a little askance at John Calvin right now, becomes the only way of talking about the cross. And if anything differs from that, it's to be dismissed and the conversation's shut down. That's really what I'm saying there.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting idea there's a way of talking about these things that ends conversation rather than inviting conversation. All right. I'm really interested in the idea that you talk about. So some of this book, or a lot of it, or maybe all of it, begins with you walking the Camino in Spain and looking at crucifixes.
Right.
And you talk about the difference between a crucifix, which is a artistic representation of Jesus on the cross, and a cross.
Yeah.
We're accustomed to in most Protestant traditions, which is a geometrical
symbol.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's abstract. It is most crosses look more or less alike. By design, And as you point out, every crucifix is different. And a crucifix is concrete. It's it's lends itself to interpretation. I'd love to hear you just talk a little bit about why you're drawn to crucifixes, even though you were raised Protestant, if I remember correctly.
I describe myself as Protestant by default, not particularly protest anything. I'm just Protestant because I'm not something else. In 2016, my wife and I, for the first time, walked the Camino de Santiago. Uh-huh. And on the first day, I just felt like the Spirit said, enter every church you can, pay attention to the crucifix, ask what this means, and don't be too quick to give an answer. And so for the next 40 days, 500 miles, I'm seeing lots of crucifixes. And because it's a walking pilgrimage, I'm on the move, I'm not seeing the same one. I'm seeing a different mm-hmm. one. And that worked with me. That worked on me. I thought, well, there's many ways of telling this story. So sometimes, Christ was serene, peaceful, or maybe even regal mm-hmm. upon the cross. Other times you clearly saw the suffering and the abhorrence of crucifixion. So there's different ways of telling that story. That spoke to me, and that was a seed for this book. I'm not against, an abstract cross that is opted for by Protestants. It's fine. I mean, first of all, it's a lot easier to draw. you don't have to be an artist to draw a cross. Okay. Yeah. I would say that it's a bit silly to be opposed to crucifixes. Sometimes you have people that want to fight about this or be dismissive of this. Well, that's Catholic and we don't want that. And I'll occasionally hear someone say, well, he's not on the cross anymore. To which I use this, he's not in the manger anymore, but you have a nativity scene. I know you. So here's the difference, though. With an abstract cross, that tends towards just an abstract theory.
Yeah.
When you look at a crucifix, you go, there's a story there, isn't there? Even if the story is, you go, man, something's going on here. What's this all about?
Yeah.
And so there's a level of pathos and story that accompanies a crucifix that may not be present in an abstract cross.
Yeah. Yeah. An abstract cross is much more antiseptic.
Yeah. Right. Exactly.
Than an image of a man being crucified. And you remark that it's a very odd thing that the most common story image on this planet is that of a man.
That's the thing. I think we're so accustomed to seeing crosses and crucifixes that we're a bit blind to them. They're so ubiquitous. We've grown up with them being around us, even if we're not a Catholic. You know what it is, and you see it. And it's Jesus, religion, stuff like that. And so that's why early on in the book, because it anthropologically, it's just, hold on. The most depicted work of art in human history is that of a man nailed to a tree. How did that come about?
Yeah.
And that's why early on in the book, I have 16 images in the book. I don't have this one mainly because I couldn't find who the cartoonist was to get permission. And then I'm not sure if IVP, I don't know how they would have felt about it. But I do describe it, though.
Yeah.
And I actually think it's brilliant. It's mm-hmm. both profane and profound. And what it is, it's a cartoon. It's just a cartoon. And two space aliens have landed on planet Earth. They've just got out of their flying saucer. This is apparently their first, encounter with planet Earth. They happen to have landed their flying saucer right next to a life-size roadside crucifix, the kind that you will find commonly in Spain. And they're just looking at this. They're staring at it. And one alien says to the other, you know what we need to do? We need to get the F out of here. That's what we need to do. I laugh every time because what that does, the humor is in recovering the absurdity of it.
Yeah.
And that the brilliance of that cartoon, and I don't know that this person was trying to make a theological point. I kind of doubt it.
Yeah.
But what the brilliance is, it allows you to see a crucifix for the first time through alien eyes.
Mm-hmm.
So I can imagine their alien minds are thinking, any planet that publicly erects images like this
Yeah.
It's not a safe place.
Yeah.
And they're not wrong.
Yeah, they're not wrong. Whereas, to your point, a cross, aliens looking at a geometric cross wouldn't have that reaction.
There's no story there.
Yeah.
And so these aliens, they go, "Ooh, there's a story here. I don't know if I like it, but there's a story here."
Yeah. I had meant to ask you when you were talking about the Camino, we got off on another subject, but could you talk about a couple of the crucifixes that you saw on that trip? That's a trip I'd like to make someday.
Yeah, well, I recommend it. And when you get ready to finally do it, talk to me and I'll give you some just good practical advice, I've done it four times.
Yeah.
Well, there's one that stands out. I mean, think about it. I'm seeing crucifix after crucifix, day after day. Some have done better than others. Some, I think, artistically are just better executed than others. I remember one where Jesus, the crown that Jesus is wearing is not a crown of thorns, but it's actually a royal crown, trying to assume, bring home the theological point that this, in fact, is the true coronation of the world's true king. Mm. But the one that stood out to me, and it occurred pretty early in the Camino, I would say about day four, I'd have to look at my journal. And we were heading toward the village. Well, I can't remember where we were heading toward, but there was a point where we could take a detour that would add, a mile to our walk that day. But where the detour went was you went up a steep hill. Yeah. And now look, I'll tell you, when you're walking 12 to 15 miles a day, you're generally not looking to add extra miles. But and to be honest, I think I have to give credit to my wife. She said, "No, we have this John Briley's guidebook. It's the best one." He said, "It's really worth it." I said, "Okay." And so we climb the steep hill, a little bit of a detour. We arrive at this beautiful little church, just tiny little church, centuries old. And there was this lovely nun that was handing out brochures that talk about the chapel in whatever language you spoke. So she would ask you where you're from, and so she would have them in French, Spanish, German, all kinds of languages. And then we walked into the chapel, and at the far end, I see a crucifix. It's very well done. It's sort of a peaceful kind of crucifix. But what was interesting, from a distance, I thought, they have depicted Jesus being crucified in a green, verdant forest. Hmm. But as I got closer, what I thought were leaves that were maybe painted were not leaves. They weren't painted. They were green post-it notes that pilgrims, there was a stack of green post-it notes there. And what you would do is you would write your prayer request and then stick it. Well, I don't know how many people are going to be actually seeing that. This is my picture of that. Uh-huh. And,
Wow. Yeah.
See, I'm trying to get it from the camera just right. But those aren't leaves. From a distance, they look like it. But those are actually post-it notes with prayer requests upon them. And I don't know, that stands out in my mind. I remember that place. I remember how peaceful it was, how kind the sister was there. And that would be one of my favorites. Another one that doesn't come from the Camino. It wasn't on the Camino, but it stands out. And it's in Florence, Italy. Of course, Florence, the home of the Renaissance. And, it's just you can't look anywhere without encountering stupendous art.
Yeah.
And this is, David's Michelangelo and Botticelli's Venus. All of that's there. But my favorite art in Florence is at the San Marco Monastery, the frescoes of Fra Angelico. He worked there for like 5 years in the late 15th century. And there's one that they're just everywhere. They cover the monk cells and the dining halls and the chapter house and everywhere you go. They're just everywhere. And they're really well done. But there's one of Jesus, a crucifixion. It's just above a dining hall as you enter. But in this, I don't know how he pulled this off, but he's an artist. He's a great artist.
Yeah.
And everything is delicate. And everything, it has a, it there's a sweetness to it. I don't think I've ever used that word in describing this one, but that's the way it is. You see a little blood, but it's just a tiny little trickle. And he's, there's this delicate halo. And what's really interesting is that this is Christ in death. His side has already been pierced. But he has this, the slightest of smiles upon his lips, as enigmatic as Mona Lisa's smile. And of course, no, this is not a journalistic reproduction of what you would see if you were actually at Golgotha on Good Friday, but this is a theological move. Mm-hmm. That this is the place also where there is beauty, and where it was, where Jesus says it is finished, and it is, and where the sin of the world is ultimately, in one way or another, dealt with. And so those two, Fra Angelico's crucifixion, I've got a picture of it here. I don't know how well you can see it. That's fun. Yeah, it's pretty tiny, but it's that one right there with the, you know.
Uh-huh.
That's with the deep blue azure background, and
yeah, it's gorgeous.
That one just that communicated peace to my soul.
Yeah, yeah. I'm interested. You've used the word journalistic. These are not journalistic representations. They are they're interpretive. They are theological.
I would say they are theopoetic interpretations.
There you go. Yeah. Huh. Okay. All right, you mentioned, you know, that Fra Angelico image was beautiful. Let's talk about beauty. Right, you've truth, goodness, beauty, the three transcendentals.
Right,
you connect those with apologetics. So truth connects to apologetics. Goodness connects to ethics.
Mm-hmm.
Beauty connects to aesthetics. Yeah. And you argue, you're not the first person to argue that we've given aesthetics short shrift here lately.
Right.
In the especially in Protestant world. Talking about why we need more beauty. And
well, I think the reason we need to lean into that is it may be the only avenue that's really open for evangelism at this particular point. I'm not against apologetics by any means. Now, it needs to be done well. There's a version of top apologetics that isn't very good. And now I'm seeing the word used as tribal gatekeepers, you know, that they call themselves apologists when they're mostly just cranks.
Okay.
But no, there, I mean, when we're talking about a legitimate Christian discipline, Christian apologetics, Christian ethics certainly have their role. I'm all for it.
Yeah.
But I'm also thinking if we take our stand in the marketplace of ideas in this current moment, and in effect announce, hey, everybody, we have absolute truth and we know what's good for you. Mm-hmm. And we meet at 10 o'clock on Sunday mornings. Well, I can imagine that largely being met with a lot of either somewhere between shoulder shrugging indifference and outright contempt, right or wrong. Mm-hmm. But beauty's different. Beauty has a way of just sneaking past your defenses. Beauty can charm you. You know, you can fall in love with beauty despite yourself.
Yeah.
And so I think we lean towards beauty, but it has to be real. And we don't get to be the arbiter on whether it's beautiful or not. It's others. So I know I'm speaking a little bit maybe abstractly here. What I mean is if we can imitate the beauty of Christ crucified in our churches, in our witness, this is a good thing. So I would say it like this. What is our posture in the wider world, speaking of the church? Are we present with, you know, like the folded arms of disdain, mm-hmm. or the clenched fist of anger, or the wagging finger of shame, or the pointing finger of accusation? Or can we adopt as our form of beauty the cruciform, arms outstretched and proffered, embrace, praying, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. If we could live beautiful lives so that you have the watching world saying something like, well, I don't know if I agree with everything those Christians are about, but you have to admit that's beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's the way forward, because this combative, angry, accusatory stance, it's ugly. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's Christ-like, and it's not going to work.
Yeah, right. If all else, I mean, if there's no other reason if no other reason gets at you, the fact that it doesn't work is one that,
right.
At the very least.
It may be just a pragmatic decision, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Right, because, well, ethics requires me to somehow conform myself to something. Truth requires me to conform my thinking to something, but beauty just sneaks up on me.
Right.
I mean, I receive it.
You mentioned something about the Protestant world. Again, I'm a Protestant. I am. I'm, again, not much protesting, but I am. somewhere along the way, and this is not a reformed move necessarily. This is just more of a utilitarian style of American evangelicalism that came about in the 20th century, mm-hmm. where we even give very little thought to artistic beauty in our worship spaces. We see mm-hmm. that as mere adornment. It's unnecessary. And I would say that for a long time I was a participant in that. Yeah. I just, you know, let our churches look like lecture halls. Like, you know, mm-hmm. you could just do a TED talk there.
Yeah.
And
this is a place where we deliver content.
Right. And at the church that I've led now for 42 years, we're trying to change that. And so we're trying to bring in more specifically Christian imagery, and then hopefully in terms of beauty. And I think that still has a lot of power. I remember when I first started visiting the great cathedrals in Europe way back in my 30s, and that's like half a lifetime ago. This was the first time for me to encounter that. And there was, at this point, there was probably a part of me that was even nervous about being in a Catholic space because it was foreign to me. And somehow I thought, you know, that wasn't my people. But I would visit these cathedrals and I would think, I'm not supposed to like this, I don't think. Mm-hmm. But I do.
Yeah, beauty snuck up on you.
You know, just the majesty, the grandeur, the beauty, just it overwhelmed me. And I think that it can happen to a lot of people. So beauty could come in a lot of different ways. It could be a beauty of lifestyle and action and compassion, but also just, you know, in architecture and in presentations of art. I think we should not be dismissive of that. Yeah. We've become too utilitarian.
Sure.
And we should say, no, there's a role for that.
Yeah. Brian, a lot of the people listening to this podcast are writers. My target audience, let's say, is writers. What do writers need to know about the importance of beauty? And or let's talk about the idea of cruciform beauty as it applies to writing.
I mean, I hesitate to give advice or anything like that, but I will say, I'll tell you, since we got writers here, I write for it to be heard out loud, not just trying to communicate the information. I want it, and you know, the reader will have to decide if I got anywhere near succeeding, but I deliberately try to write beautifully. I mean, I kind of cringe as I hear myself say that, but I actually do. And so it involves me reading out loud a lot what I write, mm-hmm. and then at the end of every writing day, asking my wife to read it back to me. And she reads it aloud, so I hear it from someone else's voice. She makes suggestions and all that sort of thing. I want to write as well as I can. And that's why I sort of, even when I'm writing stuff that is actually technically prose, I'm working for some alliteration, some meter, some rhythm. I try to write as beautifully as I can. And that's important. That to me is not mere adornment. I think it actually matters. And so I try to do that.
Because beauty matters.
Yes.
Okay. Let me follow up, though. Cruciform. What does help writers understand what the idea of cruciform beauty that you mentioned, you know, a few minutes ago, what do writers need to know about that? Quite apart from, it doesn't have to be advice necessarily. What do you just mean?
Well, we don't want to move towards kitsch, and we don't want to move towards sentimentality. And so what you have, or propaganda even.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we want to avoid kitsch and propaganda. I have a chapter called A Grotesque Beauty, because the grotesque is present. I mean, our subject matter is the crucifixion of Jesus of Nazareth under the Roman government, Governor Pontius Pilate. Look, the Romans weren't trying to create art when they crucified people. So the grotesque remains present, but we then add to that what cannot just be seen as the raw data. The raw data is that Pontius Pilate crucified a Galilean Jew named Jesus of Nazareth circa AD 30. That's the raw data, and there's nothing beautiful there.
Yeah.
The beauty is what we confess, that somehow God was in Christ reconciling the world to himself in this event, in this moment. And that's where we bring in the beauty. So, so we have to strike that balance between being true to the grotesque, but also our work is not merely the work of a journalist. Our work is the work of an artist to bring the beautiful aspects of Christ crucified. And they're present. They're there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you mentioned earlier that what's beautiful about this, about the crucifixion, is that somehow it created a reconciliation between God and man.
Right.
The beauty is not in the theory of what that somehow, you know, the writer's job is not to nail down the theory of how that works.
Well, unfortunately, that has seemingly become the task that many think that they're set out to do. And what you do is you come up with a single theory and then become argumentative, argumentative about why this is the lone interpretation of the cross and all others are wrong. I just think all that's wrongheaded. I'm not saying that anything anybody could say about the cross is true. We have to operate within the generous bounds of historic theological orthodoxy. But within those generous bounds, there's a lot to see and a lot to be brought forth, a lot to say. And so that's why this book comes, you know, I turned the kaleidoscope 19 or 20 times while looking at the cross. And I think that's legitimate. I think that's healthy. I think that's a way forward in us thinking and talking and writing about the cross.
Yeah, I appreciate that reminder that the bounds of orthodoxy are pretty generous.
They really are.
Yeah, you're, and in turning that kaleidoscope 19 times, you weren't inventing new orthodoxies. This was all within, within the orthodoxies. All right. Well, let me end with a question that I always end with, and that is, who are the writers who make you want to write? Mm-hmm.
Well, I am a devotee of Fyodor Dostoevsky to the extent that I've visited, you know, his apartment where he wrote in St. Petersburg a couple of times and kind of view it as a shrine. I mean, he wrote the Brothers Karamazov there. One of these days I'm going to teach a class on the Brothers Karamazov. I keep saying I'm going to do that. One of these days I'm going to do it. So Dostoevsky, in my mind, is the master, and he... it's interesting. If you ask him to just teach Christianity, I think it would have been terrible. but when he could channel Elder Zosima, somehow he was able then to do something he probably couldn't do as Fyodor Dostoevsky. So Dostoevsky always inspires me. Of course, I'm reading him in translation.
Right.
As far as a Christian writer who I thought, you know, if I had to stake my life on one Christian writer writing a beautiful sentence, it would be Frederick Buechner. You know, man, that guy could write.
Yeah. To return to Dostoevsky for a minute, who are your translators? Who are your favorite translators of Dostoevsky?
Well, I've read them all. And forever, I always said Pavir and Volokansky, but just within the last 6 months, I think. Michael R. Katz has a new translation, and all due respect to Pavir and Volokansky, this is now, I think, the definitive English translation.
Michael R. Katz
is brand new, and it captures Dostoevsky's humor better.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's the one I'm going to be recommending now.
Okay. Yeah, I've not. It's for me. It's always been Bevere and
Bolakowski.
Bolakowski, thank you. Yeah, okay. I'm glad
you haven't read this one. This is the new one.
Okay, I'll check it out.
I mean, when it came out, I'm enough of a Dostoevsky whatever that I just felt like, you know, a new translation, I have to read it.
Yeah.
And I'm glad I did. It's really good.
Yeah, that's good to know. All right, Brian Zahn, thanks so much for being here. It was great to talk to you. Hope we can talk again soon. When I go to the Camino, I'll call you.
Yeah, do.
Thanks.
This podcast is brought to you by The Rabbit Room, where art nourishes community and community nourishes art. And all our podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our members. To learn more about us, visit rabbitroom.com. And to become a member, rabbitroom.com/donate.